You're listening to WHUS Stores. The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences.
This is Public Talking, a show in which the public is talking. I'm a host, Zachary Kopasz. We can all agree that racism and its effects are bad. So what do we do about it? To get some answers, I spoke with Corinne Prescott, the founder of PowerUp CT at powerupmanchester.org. Hi, I'm here with Corinne Prescott, CEO of PowerUp CT.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So let's start off. What is PowerUp CT?
PowerUp CT is a grassroots organization. We got started, it's been a little over a year now. It came into existence after the murder of George Floyd. And it was important for me to address the ableism and the racism and the sexism and the transphobia and the homophobia and the isms in general, to address the cries and uplift the voices of the oppressed and the marginalized in specifically the Manchester area. But the more protesting and the more community engagement, the more people reached out and said, hey, you know, can you come here and do what you're doing in Manchester? And so the idea really is to be essentially the one-stop shop for social justice. It's important for PowerUp CT to be in the streets protesting, which is one of the things that we do, but it's also important for us to be able to meet with our legislators and press upon them the importance of passing things like SB1, which declares racism a public health crisis in the state of Connecticut, as well as community programs like our Empower You program in a HUD housing community, Squire Village, or our pantry. We don't want to just be in the streets just protesting. We want to be able to serve the community in a variety of ways.
I see. So on your website, it says that the Montgomery bus boycott lasted 380 days, but that you'll be in the streets for 391. What's the significance of that number, 391?
Well, we wanted to move past the bus boycott. And the significance, there really wasn't a significance for that specific number. I just picked a date that I wanted to make sure that we consistently stayed in the community. We've since surpassed that. We have been in the community in a number of ways. Every single day showing up for the people. And we understood that consistency is really what keeps the movement alive. It keeps the voices alive. It keeps hope in the hearts of the people. And so we just wanted to be able to take the energy of what they did in Montgomery and take that in and use that to further the fight for justice.
That's great. So you've not only exceeded 380, you've exceeded 391.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
All right. So let's talk about your list of demands. I noticed first demand listed on the website, racism declared a public health crisis. You've got a check mark next to that.
That's so, a huge one.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I don't know anything about public health. So what happens when something gets declared a public health crisis?
Well, just look at COVID, for instance. Something gets declared a public health crisis, and it basically puts the community on high alert. It puts our legislators on high alert. It puts all of the systems. So the healthcare system, educational system, the judicial system, all of the systems become on high alert, and it shines a light on that particular disease. If we take COVID, for instance, once it became a pandemic, it is a health crisis, a public health crisis, mandates go into place. We know that a lot of money is flowing. A lot of COVID-19 dollars are flowing across the country and across the world, honestly, to attack this disease so we can somehow either cure it or, you know, get vaccinated so that way we can fight against the disease to stop the spread of it and to protect ourselves from potentially dying from the disease. You have mandates like social distancing and wearing a mask and, you know, kids weren't allowed to be in schools and people weren't able to go into restaurants. And all that is because you're saying, hey, this thing is so bad and people are dying from it at alarming rates. We really need to move into action so that way we can be able to prevent deaths and prevent people from getting sick and having long-term, health challenges as a result. And so you take that, and the same goes for racism. People have been dying for well over 500 years as a result of racism.
Right.
There are systems in place to perpetuate white supremacy, capitalism, racism, ableism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and so we're saying that, yes, all the other systems or isms, I should say, are a problem. But I truly believe that all of the other isms are byproducts of racism. And so if we can eradicate that, we can essentially eradicate all the isms. You look at a health crisis like COVID-19 and you see that Black and Latinx and brown people were being infected and dying from it at alarming rates, much more than our white counterparts.
Right.
Well, that's as a result of racism, not having access to adequate health care, affordable health care, working lower income jobs that put you at more at risk, potentially having to work in places and work hours that don't allow you to protect yourself or work from home because you are living in a neighborhood and you have a landlord who is not going to be as forgiving. When your rent is late or when you can't even pay that month. So everything that we look at going on around us is as a result of racism. And so, you know, declaring it as a public health crisis is basically trying to tell the world, like, hey, wake up. This is a problem. You know, you might see memes that say what is happening to Black men in the street is what's happening to Black women, you know, in terms of maternal health. And that's true. A Black woman can be the same age and have the same level of education as well as make the same amount of money as a white woman. And yet that Black woman has a higher chance of dying during labor or childbirth as well as her child dying simply because she's Black. So it is a serious health crisis. It is a pandemic. And there needs to be a lot more attention, a lot more focus, a lot more funds and resources to address it.
So by declaring it a public health crisis, do you believe that will make it easier to further your other goals?
Absolutely, because you can't cure what you don't diagnose. You can have all the symptoms of cancer and you can go to the doctor constantly and say, you know, I'm losing weight and you know, I'm coughing up blood and I'm not eating well and I lost my appetite. You can say all these symptoms and they can just sit there and be like, wow, I don't know how we can, you know, they can prescribe you everything else but what you need. Let's say what you need is chemo. And they're like, no, this isn't working. And it's like, well, if we declare this or if we diagnose this as cancer, run all the tests, all the symptoms are there, then we can adequately cure it. We can adequately address it. We can prescribe the right medications. We can get you to the right specialist. And so then you are on a path towards healing. Our country can't begin the path towards healing until we fully acknowledge how we got here today. If we sit around and say, how did we get to a George Floyd? I'll tell you, it's because we never started the healing process from Emmett Till. That's how we got to a George Floyd.
Your next demand is that Juneteenth be declared a holiday. Could you explain about Juneteenth and why it should be a holiday?
Yes. In layman's terms, it is when enslaved Africans became free. They actually became free, I want to say it was like 1863. but there was no Twitter. There were no phones to be able to call the slaves down in Texas from, you know, D.C., so to speak, and say, hey, you guys can go now. No. So although the slave masters knew, they knew that the majority of their slaves didn't read and couldn't write. Mm-hmm. And it was a law that they couldn't. And so they weren't picking up the local paper to read what was going on. And so it took some time for a lot of time, a couple years, for the word to travel to, you know, the last group of enslaved Africans to find out that they, in fact, no longer were enslaved. But that's why we see T-shirts and memes that say free-ish, because even though, you know, it was some writing, the truth of the matter is there were just more systems in place to keep them enslaved. The truth of the matter is we really just went from, you know, enslaved Africans and indigenous people on cotton fields, and they just transferred them to prisons. So, you know, essentially Juneteenth is acknowledging, and again, it's like going down the path, trying to get down the path of healing, acknowledging the wrongdoing. So by declaring Juneteenth a holiday, which we have been able to do.
I noticed that. So we can check that off.
Thank you. And not just, you know, in Manchester, but in the country. And so by declaring that, you're saying, yes, we did enslave people. We did kidnap them, traffic them, transport them as if they were some Yeezys across the sea, and then sell them and rip families apart and rape the women and slaughter the men, and abuse and misuse and rape the children. Yes, we did that. And eventually, at some point, we decided we were no longer going to do that. Not because they believed it was wrong, but really it was strategic, a strategic move in terms of politics and making sure that there were counted as people, so that way there could be more votes. Right. You know, so you know, it's something to be celebrated, because it did begin the path towards liberation, but we're still not fully liberated.
So your next demand, establish a civilian review board. So what does a civilian review board look like?
Which, by the way, we can check that off.
Oh, I didn't see that on the website.
Manchester, yes, we have not updated it, and it needs to be. But yes,
that's great.
There was a vote last spring and close to... Yeah, it was in the spring, and the vote was in favor of a civilian review board for the police department. And that is pretty much exactly as it sounds. We want civilians. We want people like myself and you. We want people who are, you know, making six figures to people who are earning less than a living wage. We want people working in healthcare. We want people that are retired. We want the young, and we want the elders. We want the queer and the trans, and we want the heterosexuals, and we want the men and the women and the they and the people to come together and say, we're going to hold this police department accountable. When you do wrong, and when you murder unarmed people like Jose Soto, we're going to get together. We're going to take a look at the facts. We're going to take a look at the record of that officer or those officers. We want to look at any complaints against them. And we want to be able to make a determination. Were you justified in what you were doing? And a lot of people feel as though that is something that's wrong. But every system has checks and balances. And if there's nothing corrupt or wrong happening behind the scenes, then why not be transparent? Right. Why not allow the very people that you are looking to provide some sort of law and order over to stand and to come together and be able to say, we're gonna hold you accountable when things don't happen the way that they're supposed to happen. We're gonna hold you accountable when we begin to look at data and see that Black and Brown and Latinx people are getting pulled over way more than white people. And we want to say, why is that? What is happening? What is going on? Why are areas in Manchester, like the Spruce Street area, so much more heavily policed than areas in Manchester where Gino Auriemma lives?
Right.
So that is the purpose of a civilian review board. It is to review, for the civilians to come together and to review the misconduct of officers who have taken an oath to uphold the law. And so when you break the law, you should be held accountable.
That's right. And so that sort of ties in to another demand, which is defunding the police. You know, you mentioned that funding for the police has gone up every year. So when you say defund the police, do you mean stop increasing the budget or start decreasing the budget?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
I think we can start by stopping to increase. You know, if people took a look at many of their municipal or town budgets, they would see that a lot of times education loses funding, and you have board of educations and superintendents looking for grants and looking for other ways to be able to provide the necessary services for their staff, their teacher, and the children and their families. And meanwhile, we are increasing the budget for police departments to be able to buy military grade vehicles and weapons. And I don't know about you, but the last time I checked, Manchester was not on America's Most Wanted list for for any type of domestic terrorism. That's a different thing, because we definitely have some white supremacists in Manchester who actually attended the insurrection January 6th. And so if you were looking, if they're looking to increase the budget to be able to keep an eye on them, then I'd be all for it. But that's not what they're doing.
Right.
And so there's no need for them to have military grade weapons. So, yes, we don't need to keep increasing the budget. One of the things that I've noticed with Manchester, they want to increase the budget because they want to upgrade the locker rooms. I mean, if I have to decide between my tax dollars going to a locker room and providing, you know, more services for our community in terms of mental health, I'm going to go with mental health. If I have to decide between increasing the budget of the police department, you know, for military grade weapons versus providing, you know, free before and after child care, so parents can have, you know, ease of mind when they're dropping their kids off in a safe place, so that they can work, so they can provide for their families, I'm going to go with the free before and after child care. So, yes, it's a little bit of both. It is not increasing the funds. And then being as a single Black woman, I know how to finagle some stuff. I know how to rob Peter to pay Paul. I know how to tell this bill collector to put on hold because it's not that important. I know how to get rid of cable and go with Netflix and Hulu. Like, as a Black woman, I could probably balance America's budget, you know, because I don't have a lot to work with and I got three kids. So it's the same thing. Let's be a little bit more responsible with the money that you do have, versus just getting more and more, spending it frivolously, and it's not doing any good for the community. So let's stop increasing the budget. And then over time, yes, we can decrease the budget. If we begin to decrease the budget and start, you know, redirecting those funds into areas like childcare, like healthcare, mental health services, education, you'll start to notice that where you see things happening as a result in terms of like crime, and I use kind of like air quotes, you will start to see those numbers decrease if people feel like their needs are being met. Not everyone who is on welfare, not everyone who's on Social Security is lazy or stupid or uneducated. I'm a differently abled body. I have multiple sclerosis and a non-cancerous brain tumor. I tried to apply for disability at one point, and that system is trash and repeatedly got denied. And so you look at somebody like myself who has a bachelor's degree, graduated on Dean's List, and can't afford to put food on their kids' table. I could tell you it's not because I'm not smart. I'm building a machine here with Power Up. And so if we could get some more services to be able to help the people to take care of their basic needs, then a lot of things that you're seeing out there, people being, if we can take that money and put it towards people with substance abuse issues, then I can tell you that a lot of the issues that we're seeing, a lot of the crimes that we are seeing, they won't be there, which means that you don't need so many officers and you definitely don't need military grade weapons and vehicles.
Right. So not just defund, but redirect the funds.
Absolutely.
There's one point on your list of demands, inclusive community for LGBTQ plus people of color. I believe this is in reference to the schools of Manchester.
Yes.
And so I notice it says reparations for those who were hurt should by bullying or hate speech in schools should be given.
Yes.
So what does reparations look like in the context of a school?
Well, the biggest thing is that there should be, in my opinion, healthcare at the school level, almost, so to speak, like a Planned Parenthood, but in the school. When you're talking about sexual health, most times minors do not have to have the consent of a parent to get certain treatments. The things that they discuss with their medical provider, as well as their mental health provider, stay if a child doesn't want, they are a teenager, doesn't want their parents in the room. They can't be in the room. They can ask their parent to be excused. And so, in my opinion, I think that we need to start moving towards putting a mental health clinician that does not work for the state and that does not work for the Board of Education inside of the schools. And so that way they're not there to answer to the school or the state, but instead they are truly there to advocate and to help the community. We find that, especially with the trans community, that especially the trans Black community, that bullying, even to go as far as to say the deaths of many Black trans people, those are crimes that are going uninvestigated. Those names, we're not seeing hashtag, they're just being swept under the rug. And so there needs to be something in place in the school for this community to be able to go to be able to get the services and the help and the treatment that they need, not just, like physical health, but also mental health treatment. And to me, that is where the reparations can begin. It can begin by literally building an office space and building a safe zone for students who identify as part of the LGBTQ plus community and it's intersectional, not only identify in that community, but who are Black and Brown and Latinx as well. And so that way, if they feel they can't go anywhere else, they can go here. And many students can't go to their parents. And that's why it needs to be at the school level. So when they're showing up for school, they can also be able to address these other needs, not just their academic needs.
You also say that we should require mandatory cultural diversity and anti-racism training at companies and other organizations. So what makes anti-racism different than just diversity training?
And I think we need to update that one, because I would add in there, I would keep both of those, but I would also add an anti-Black racism. Because that is a very specific thing outside of anti-racism. Cultural diversity, that can be students who move up here from Black students from the South. For instance, my niece lives in Maryland, Hyattsville, Maryland. They have their own way of speaking. I don't even understand that amongst the Black youth there. They literally have their own language.
Oh.
It is not even part of, like Ebonics or the AAVE language. It is literally their own language. My daughter and my niece talk and I have no clue what the heck they are saying. None. We used to live in Maryland as well. So you take something maybe as simple as that and you have kids that come up here we're not going to tell them that the way that they're speaking is wrong simply because it doesn't fit into, you know, Western culture, because it doesn't fit into American culture. What we're going to do instead is we're going to provide training to the teachers, even to the students, help them understand that, listen, this is not something that's to be mocked. If this is how they speak and this is how they write, then perhaps you should start beginning to learn this language so you can be able to understand them, so you can communicate better.
Right.
This is, you know, people who aren't in Philadelphia. You have a large population of Black Muslims. They were born right here in America. They are fully garbed up, and they are... they have a very large community. Cultural diversity and training, that's helping to understand there are some differences that Black Muslim community, they have very different differences than, you know, Asian Americans who are Hindu or who are Muslim, or who are Buddhist or Catholic. There's going to be some cultural differences based on where they were born and raised, based on their religion, based on how they grew up. It's almost like that nature versus nurture. And so in order to make the community inclusive, then you need to learn about all these different types of religions and the way in which they dress and why they may never wear. You have some Seventh-day Adventists, you have some other Christian religions where they don't ever wear pants. And so, you know, making sure that the school kind of highlights that, so kids aren't making fun of girls coming to PE and they have to wear a long skirt.
Right.
They can't wear shorts. They can't wear sweatpants. So instead of giving her a zero, you're understanding, you know what? That's her religion. That's where you talk about cultural diversity and understanding and being more cognizant of someone's culture versus racism, anti-racism, where we're really focusing on discriminating against someone, attacking someone, bullying someone, hating someone simply because of the color of their skin, simply because of where they were born, what country they were born, what language they speak. And then you have anti-Black racism, which is where you can have other communities of color that uphold some of the same racist stereotypes and racist behaviors specifically towards just Black people. So that actually needs to be updated, because we should add that in.
So you also say holding businesses accountable for discrimination, and that claims should be investigated by a third party that's not the HR department or their affirmative action department. So is this third party, is that related to the Civilian Review Board, or is this a separate entity?
I think that at some point it can be a branch of the Civilian Review Board that is connected to each town's chamber of commerce. And so, you know, if you go to your town's chamber of commerce, you'll get, like, you can get a booklet and it have a printout of all the businesses that's in that town. Well, if I decide to go to a specific business in town and, you know, I notice that I'm standing there waiting to be seated and they're looking right past me, and then I see, you know, some white people come in, they seat them, and I see another group of white people and they seat them, and then I ask to speak to someone and they ignore me, and then finally somebody seats me but they're not taking my order, but they're taking everybody else's order, and I realize the only thing that's different in this entire restaurant is me because I'm Black, then yes, there should be a place, and maybe it's the Chamber of Commerce, where I can go ahead and I can make a complaint. And the reason why that's important is because racism and anti-Black racism, it is ingrained in every area of our lives. And if we don't have checks and balances in every area of our lives, that's how you continue to perpetuate this hatred. That's how you continue to give privilege and entitlement to people, because the system is upholding that hatred. It seems like something that is impossible, but everything is possible if people are serious about wanting true diversity and equity and inclusion. I hate those groups, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, you see all these towns and these board of educations creating these diversity, inclusion and equity groups. And it's just basically a time for a lot of white people to get together and spill their white tears. And I'm not here for it. And for a lot of performative activism. And I'm not here for that either. So my thing is, if you're serious about it, then we need to have checks and balances. We need to not just sit and kind of have like a kumbaya moment. Just let's talk about this. We need to bring in actual stories of, yes, this happened at such and such business on, you know, 12345 Main Street, you know, and then you start hearing from other people when that civilian review board for, let's say, the Chamber of Commerce starts reaching out to folks and saying, hey, did this happen to you? You know, and they start adding up the debt and saying, okay, well, at this restaurant, we have 15 complaints of queer people. We have 15 complaints of trans people. We have 15 complaints of Asian people. We have 15 complaints of Black people. No complaints from white people about not being sat down and not getting their order taken. But we have all these other complaints. What are we going to do about that? It's not enough to just boycott. We have to have a system in place to say, no, you're not going to do that. You're just not going to do it. You got to answer to somebody for that.
So there has to be a third party for there to be real accountability.
Absolutely.
This is just a quick one. You say, remove the Star Spangled Banner.
Mm.
Why should we remove the Star Spangled Banner?
Why should we have the Star Spangled Banner? You know, we always talk about separating religion and politics from school. And then we got not only the Pledge of Allegiance, but the Star Spangled Banner at a sporting event. Why? Why? That's not a fight song that you write that for that specific school and that team. Now, if you want to have a fight song or some sort of, I don't know, like I'm from Philly, so I know, you know, F-L-Y-E-A, Fly Eagles, Fly. You know what I mean? Like, that's different. You know, you want to have a song. I don't know what the Huskies have. If you want to have a song for the Huskies, play that. But the Star Spangled Banner, and then you want me to stand up for what? You weren't talking about us. We weren't included in those lyrics. So what are we singing that for? Why are we singing that? That does not pertain to Black people. That doesn't pertain to Indigenous people. That does not include, you know, Latinx and Brown people. It does not include us. Why are we? What is the reason? In my Cardi B voice, what is the reason? Why are we singing that? Can we just get to the game, you know, and many people are going to, you know, listen to this and they're like, OK, you're going too far. You know what? Y'all went too far with Columbus on Indigenous People Day. Like, we all went too far. You went to another country. You stole people. You sold them. You raped them. You killed them. You hung them. You created all these laws and systems in place. And then you got the nerve to write a song. You have the nerve to write a song to support your genocide and your rape, and then you want me to stand up and honor that? You want me to stand up and honor a country that does not give a damn about me? No, absolutely not. I don't stand up for that song, and I won't stand up for that song. It has nothing to do with me not... Listen, my grandfather fought in the war. Don't ask me which one. My mother's mother. I don't pay attention. But what I do know is that his alcoholism and his PTSD... It went unchecked. There was nothing there to help him with that. There was no monies to help him pay his bills when he couldn't work because he was too drunk. Because he was trying to drown out the noise of the trauma of killing people and seeing his friends being killed in the war. So I don't want to hear people saying that we are disrespecting our veterans. And tell me, if you think that not playing a song is disrespect, then why do we have so many veterans out begging for change, panhandling? Why do we have so many veterans homeless? Why do we have so many veterans taking their lives? But somehow this song needs to be played so we can honor our veterans? No, absolutely not. And if you're going to play that, then play. If we want to keep that. Okay, but then we need to play the black national anthem. Because that matters.
So I believe I touched on all of the demands. Let me know if I'm missing one.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Power Up CT started, it started within the times of the coronavirus. How do you think that's affected the way it's been able to grow? Like, what's organizing like when there's a pandemic?
Ooh, sorry, that again. It's funny because everybody was ready to come out in massive numbers in the midst of a pandemic right after the murder of George Floyd. But as the beaches opened, the restaurants and the clubs and the breweries and, you know, the amusement parks, you swiftly started to see the numbers decrease. And so, to be honest, I don't think that the coronavirus really is the issue. I think that people really just don't care. The thing that really makes it difficult in terms of organizing really more so is trying to find the balance of making sure I don't put more Black and Brown lives at risk by coming out into public spaces. But people, it's very interesting that the people who stand on the side of Black Lives Matter, the movement, also care about social distancing and wearing their mask. And yet it's very weird that the people who could care less about Black lives, whether it's the movement or just my life in general or any Black life, they're also the ones who don't think coronavirus is real. And if they do think it's real, they don't really care too much about social distancing, wearing masks, or being vaccinated. So that dynamic is really, really interesting to me. And so I'd say that it's difficult organizing in the sense that I don't want to put more Black and Brown people, anyone at risk, but more specifically Black and Brown people at risk. But I also recognize that there has been a pandemic that has been along for our people far longer than the coronavirus. And we can't. Racism didn't take a pause when coronavirus happened. We look at Elijah McClain, I think Ahmaud Arbery, you know, and George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Racism didn't. Jose Soto. I was spit on in the face at the Capitol on January 6th. Racism does not take a break. We look at the two Black and Native cheerleaders from Montville who were yelled at by East Catholic High School students, go home, and they use the N-word. They spit on them, spit at them, threw water at them. The coronavirus didn't stop them. So why should I slow down? Why should I stop? I can't. And if I don't do what I'm doing, if things are as bad as they are now in the midst of coronavirus, even with me out there day in and day out, what would happen if I wasn't out there? What would happen if other organizations like USIC or like ABAC or BLM 860 or BLM New Haven, what would happen? You know, Power Up UConn, what would happen if they weren't out there? What it would be much worse. And so we can't. We want to be careful and we want to be mindful and we want to be cautious and we want to be smart about how we organize. But we listen, the movement must continue. The fight must go on.
What's Power Up doing now? Like, what's the future going forward? What's Power Up CT going to keep doing?
Well, right now, a lot of fundraising. We set a goal of June 1st was our 1 year anniversary. And at that event, we had a goal of raising $100,000. To date, I believe we are at about, I want to say $65,000. Wow. That we have raised. And we really started fundraising like around May, June. So that's pretty impressive. I probably should have dreamed bigger and had a higher number. And that's really for two initiatives. I want to create jobs for people paying a real living wage by creating this one program called Empower You. I want to be able to expand that. So right now we're in Squire Village twice a week. And the goal is to really, we can reach all children, but the emphasis on Black and Brown children as they have been hit by two pandemics, Black, Brown, and Latinx children. And to be able to address their mental health issues, their anxiety and their depression surrounding the disease, as well as race, the disease of coronavirus and racism, by bringing things to them like yoga, mindfulness and meditation, journaling, arts and crafts, football, basketball, African dance, African drumming, creating jobs so that way we can hire Black and brown instructors to do these classes in Squire Village, hiring mentors, high school mentors from Manchester, to pay them $15 an hour to work with the youth, to give them opportunity to come up with some ideas of classes that they themselves can teach so they can learn some basic leadership skills and give them a chance at a first job. And we want to expand that. So we'll be going into Bennett Academy, which is the fifth and sixth grade class. And then we also are starting our research program on patient advocates in emergency rooms to be able to show up for patients when they are discriminated against by a clinician, by a nurse, or by a doctor simply because they're Black or brown or queer or differently abled. And so a patient advocate will come in and be able to hear what the patient needs and then be able to report to the hospital administrators in the state when this clinician, when this healthcare provider is discriminating against this patient, so we can start to track that data in the healthcare system. And last but not least, we are working with some folks in Houston who are helping our brothers and sisters from Haiti. And we're going to be adopting a couple of families who have made their way here and who have been sponsored by others. And so now they're here. And so we want to be able to provide some things this winter and this Christmas, gifts and clothes and food and rent and so on and so forth. So, you know, those are our three major kind of like community engagement. And then as far as protesting, we are going to continue to be at East Catholic High School because of what happened to those Black and Native cheerleaders. And so we want to get justice for those two cheerleaders. So that's on the protest side. And, you know, we're going to continue to do our community programs like our bike drive and our coat drive and continue to start start already the planning for our celebration for Juneteenth next year to make it bigger and better, because each year so far it has gotten bigger and better.
So how can people help out inside or outside of Manchester?
Great question. They can email us at powerupmanchester@gmail.com. They can donate if they want to donate monetarily. They can email us and let us know how they would like to do that. If they want to donate bikes or scooters for a bike drive, they can email us and let us know. They can also email Winter Clothing. They can, did I say email Winter Clothing? I don't
you
know.
Did.
I meant donate Winter Clothing for a Winter Clothing drive. We have a very large pantry that doesn't just have food, but it has sanitary napkins. And so sanitary napkins, diapers, wipes, socks are some of our bigger items that we really are the biggest items we really try to get in. And so we are always looking for, constant donations for our pantry. We need volunteers for the pantry. We're always looking to influence, persuade, connect with our legislators. And so whenever there's a bill that comes along similar to like what SB1 was, that we really need to hear our voices be heard, we're always looking for people to submit written testimony if they can't come and testify via Zoom. So, the biggest thing is to follow us on social media, Power Up Manchester on Facebook, Power Up CT on Instagram, or email us or go to our website. And there's so many things that they can do to get involved and to, you know, further the movement. There's so many things that they can do to power up, so to speak.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
I'm really excited and I'm really appreciative of this time and this space and to be able, you know, when I walked on campus, I'm like, I'm so happy I am out of college. I do not miss this one bit. But you guys are what's up next. You guys aren't even up next. You guys are here now. Your voices need to be heard now. So, you know, there's a lot of students here from all walks of life. And I want to believe that there are more students who want to stand on the side of justice than there are that don't. And so my biggest thing is to, you don't have to talk like me. You don't have to protest like me. You don't have to fight like I do. You are needed just the way you are. You're going to reach someone with your personality and with your voice and with your demeanor. Don't be afraid to use it.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Public Talking. If you or someone you know is offering actionable solutions to issues in our community, let us know. We would love to hear you talk. Publicly, even.